When Lou Gillette first spoke at the forum, he was introduced as the alligator penis man in honor of his research. He's one of the forum attendees' favorite speakers. Lou is considered a pioneer researcher on endocrine disruption and reproductive effects. He studied the decline of Lake Apopka's alligators, and he's currently the director of the Marine Biomedicine and Environmental Sciences Center and professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the Medical University of South Carolina, professor of the Howard Hughes Institute, and Smart State Endowed Chair in Marine Genomics at South Carolina Center of Economic Excellence. His current work examines the effect of environmental pollutants on the genetic endocrine signaling system associated with the development and functioning of the genitalia and gonads of various vertebrates. Please join me in welcoming Lou Gillette.
The title is Alligators. I figured I had to start with an alligator picture. So, I know you saw lots of farmland yesterday. Hope you saw an alligator.
Did you see an alligator?
Yes.
Okay, well, we have a couple of pictures of alligators today. The title of this talk that I sent was Sentinel Species, What Are They Telling Us? The subtitle is basically 25 years of environmental endocrine disruptor research and some stories and maybe some things that I've learned. It's always kind of weird for me to give talks to groups like this because I'm talking to the choir. I don't actually have to convince you guys that the environment's important and that health of the environment's important. But what I'd like to do is to break the talk this morning into two sections. I'd like to do a little philosophical thing to talk about. It's astonishing. Jay and I did not talk before this, so he has no idea what I was actually going to say today. But many of the points that he made, I'm going to focus on. And then I'll tell you a little bit about Lake Apopka. And I still work on Lake Apopka. I left, was at the University of Florida for 25 years as a professor. We still come down every year. In fact, I will be back down here in about 6 or 8 weeks working on Lake Apopka, working on lakes still here in Florida. And it's sad to say, but we're still finding many of the same things that we actually found 25 years ago. So with that as a thing, I thank Jay. I'm very, very disappointed that they didn't have my replacement t-shirt that they gave me 14 years ago with a very nice dragonfly on it, but he tells me they're going to do it again. So, let me start with a couple of things. I don't have a pointer, but it doesn't matter. You can see the trends. I wanted to put this up because we all kind of know it, but we don't know it because the public relations is telling us something very different. What you're in fact seeing is that this is looking at prostate, breast cancer, testicular cancer over time. And what you can see is that every single one of these is going up. What we're hearing is cancer deaths are down. That's true, thank God. But the fact is that the rate of cancer, or the increase in cancer by population, continues to increase, especially in endocrine cancers, especially in neurological cancers. Now, the premise of our understanding of disease for much of the last 50, 60, 70 years has been associated with what I call genes and germs. The fact is, we think of disease either as pathogenic organisms or genetic determinism. We have a mutation we inherit from mom or dad, that leads to disease. You're exposed to ionizing radiation, leads to disease. Exposed to a couple of chemicals, leads to disease. The fact is, what we now know with the Human Genome Project is that there is not going to be a gene for Alzheimer's. There's not going to be a gene for attention deficit syndrome. And in fact, most of the diseases we're dealing with, breast cancer, prostate cancer, testicular cancer, and a whole series of other things, only about 15 or 20% of the cases are associated with specific gene mutations. We are in a new world, and that new world is what's in fact epigenetic determination. That is where the environment is playing a much, much bigger role than we ever dreamed in leading to disease. And in fact, many of these diseases are not associated with specific genetic mutations. They're associated with changes in gene expression. How is your genome actually being regulated? How does that lead to a predisposition for disease? How does that, in fact, lead to disease? So what I'd like to do this morning, very quickly, is to kind of give you what I would maybe say is my top five lessons that I've actually learned in basically 25 years of doing environmental science, and then talk about alligators. And the first lesson is, kids are different. Kids, embryos, whatever you want to call them, they are not little adults, and they're not big mice. They are fundamentally different in how they process chemicals and how, in fact, they grow and develop. They are, in fact, different, although most of the toxicology that is still done is actually done on adult animals, and then we try to predict what goes on in all the other stages of life. Let me show you one data set, which for me is stunning. And this brings this message home. This is actually DDT association with breast cancer. What you actually see on the bottom line is the age of this girl or girls. If you are less than 4 years old and you are exposed to the highest levels of environmental DDT, these are not little girls working in DDT factories, the odds ratio of developing breast cancer is astronomical. Having basically an 11-fold increase in your chances of getting the disease is astronomical from a medical perspective. In contrast, if you've reached puberty and you're greater than 14 years of age, your odds ratios of developing breast cancer are the same as if you're not exposed. So what does that actually tell us? Well, what it tells us is something which has actually been emerging and is now quite extensively funded by the National Institutes of Health, is something we call the embryonic or fetal origins of adult disease. That is, many of the diseases that we are in fact seeing today are set up during embryonic development or early childhood life. This is not a hypothesis anymore. It originally started off as something called the Barker hypothesis. It originally started off by looking at low-weight babies born from 1945 during basically what was in fact World War II, the Holland famine, which was created when the Nazis blocked off Holland and there was a major famine in Holland. Women were pregnant during the first trimester of that famine. Their babies actually had a higher chance of developing cardiovascular disease. It was completely opposite of what was predicted. A low-weight baby, later in life developing heart disease, just didn't make sense originally until the developmental biologist got involved and said, well, you do know when the heart and circulatory system develops, right? During the first trimester. That's when, in fact, a lot of this set up. But what about if they actually went through the same low nutrition, but during the last trimester? The last trimester is when your brain is not just growing, but all those neurological systems are being set up. And so therefore, if you actually see low nutrition during late trimester, what you in fact have is a much higher incidence of depression, diabetes, schizophrenia, antisocial behaviors. So the take home is, we know that the embryo is in fact sensing the environment. This happens to be some basic things, but what about my world? My world is reproductive biology. So the Johnson Family Foundation gave me a grant a number of years ago. We brought together what were about 10 or 15 of the top people in the world in reproductive biology and developmental medicine. We looked at thousands of papers, and what we were able to show is that these eight general diseases, or if you will, conditions, we want to call them, that young women appear in a gynecology or an obstetrics practice. And what we were able to show is that every single one of these conditions, there is evidence that they can in fact be established during embryonic development. Now these are things like polycystic ovary syndrome, endometriosis fibroids, which are epidemic in the United States, they're epidemic in Western Europe, and they continue to grow. Now yes, several of these conditions can be established by certain kinds of exposures, stress, etc., later in life, during the reproductive years, but all of them have the potential basis to be set up during embryonic development. So, like in photography, timing is almost everything. And it's really critical for us to actually start thinking about when these exposures are actually taking place. Now, you heard about ecosystems, and I will hammer home today that mixtures are, in fact, the world that we're dealing with. We are never, ever, from my perspective, going to predict what goes on in a real population by studying one chemical at a time, or even studying one variable at a time. When we actually look at the health of a baby, we now know that it's not just the genetics that you inherit from mom or dad. We've always known that nutrition played a role. That's why we, in fact, propose folic acid and various other things, you know, vitamins during pregnancy. We know that these variables are important. We know that drugs have the potential to alter the phenotype or the health of that offspring, both illegal as well as legal drugs. But what about personal care products? Well, we now know that's definitive. And we've just, in fact, confirmed it ourselves. We've just finished a 400 pregnant mom study in the last couple of months. We're finished basically finalizing all of the genetics, not all of the genetics, we're doing that too, but all of the statistics. And what we're actually finding, and for the first time, we actually have half 200 African-American women as well as 200 Caucasian women, and we are finding that personal care products have measurable effects on their offspring. And for the first time, not just baby boys, but baby girls as well. And I'm not going to go into that data today. As I said, we're still trying to finalize the stats. But the take home is, these variables are real. More importantly, all of these phenomena contribute to this developing offspring. So just studying contaminants among, or just studying genetics, or just studying personal care products is not going to give us what we need to understand about the potential health of that child later in life. Now, that doesn't mean that this group and your focus isn't important. Understand what I'm trying to say is that it is important, but it's in context to all the other things that, in fact, a young woman or a family is exposed to. And it's not just us. The fact is that every organism is dealing with the same mix. They may not be getting illegal drugs. They probably are getting illegal pesticides or whatever else into their environment. But the take home is, my alligators did not go to a physician and get a pharmaceutical. They're dealing with what we're dumping into the environment. They're basically dealing with environmental change. Oh, climate change. I'm not allowed to say that because I'm from South Carolina. But modifications in environment. So one of the things that we've actually spent a lot of time in the last 5 years trying to figure out is, how do you study complexities? And so I put this up as just a very quick thing. We published a major paper in Environmental Science Technology. It took us forever to get it through because the reviewers didn't understand the statistics. What we in fact took was a page from national security. What we in fact did is machine learning. The ability to take complex patterns, like you do when you walk through the airport, they try and recognize who you are by taking your picture and running it through a database of a billion people. Fact is, we said, what happens if you take hundreds and hundreds of data points and put it in, can you recognize disease patterns? And so we did something a bit different. I'm in a marine lab, we're interested in algal blooms and algal toxins, largely associated with nutrients that we're dumping into the environment. We looked at three algal toxins, but what we actually asked is, what about metals in the environment? Because we know iron plays a role. What about temperature? And not to go into belabor the point, we basically looked at 18 different variables at 10 different levels. That's 18 to the 10th. We're talking millions of possible combinations. The whole NIH budget cannot do that experiment, okay? And in fact, everybody in this room, if they worked their whole careers, couldn't do that experiment. But we asked the computer, tell us 200 possible combinations randomly throughout the whole hyposphere. And we did it. And it said, you need to do a few more. So we did a total of 260 possible combinations compared to 18 to the 10th power. And what we, in fact, were able to show is that we could predict with 90% assurance what, in fact, the most complex and most important interactions were. Is 90% okay for public health? I think so. Now, is this 95% confidence in the mechanisms? No, but you know what we're now doing? We're taking those most complex interactions and we're doing the next set of experiments. So it allows us not only to test, but it gives us the next generation of hypotheses that we can actually go and ask, what are the most important combinations? And as you see, these complex relationships, these three-dimensional relations, are not linear dose response curves. Lesson number three, it's not just toxicity. We always love to think about chemicals being tested for their toxicity. Yes, chemicals kill things, but most of us are not, in fact, dealing with death. What we're dealing with is changes in health. And so it's really important that we look at different endpoints, and of course, that's part of the story of endocrine disruption. We lost two giants in the last couple of years in this field. The older gentleman that's sitting next to Taiaguchi in that picture is Howard Byrne. He's the guy who discovered the DES daughter, who many of us know about the DES daughter complex. Howard was my mentor, and actually Tyrone Hayes' mentor. So you have two Howard Byrne proteges here talking to you today. And the woman sitting next to Howard is mom. That's Theo Culbert. And so Theo was, in fact, the one that stimulated most of us, in fact, I would say almost all of us, to actually start thinking about endocrine disruption and being part of this. And for many years, she was the only one that actually believed that what we were doing was important And unfortunately, I talked to her just a couple of days before she passed away here last December. The take home is that this is no longer the endocrine disruptor hypothesis. We are absolutely sure that this is real. And it's not just real in wildlife, it's real in humans. So real that the NIH now in fact posts things like this, where they can actually say there's over 1,000 chemicals we now know are endocrine disruptors. And they in fact bridge the gamut of the kinds of things that we're exposed to every day. Endocrine disruption, it's important to recognize, is not just the ability of a chemical to bind, let's say, a hormone receptor. It is the ability for it to modify the central nervous system, the hypothalamus, the pituitary. It's the ability to actually alter, for example, how the gonads, ovaries and testes, or thyroid, makes critical hormones that actually are involved not just in development, but in reproduction and in general health. It also modifies the liver. So, in the last 25 years, my lab has actually been establishing, or has established, that all of these levels of organization can be disrupted by exposure to mixtures of agricultural chemicals, i.e. pesticides.